So I guess we got to start off with the title and the concept of the show, Death, Sex, and Money. That's not only startling, but also kind of heavy, right?
Yeah. What I was trying to get at is just that this is an interview show where we're not going to be talking to people on book tours necessarily or hearing interviews that you're hearing everywhere else, but really trying to have conversations about things that we think about a lot but don't talk about enough. And that's the slogan of the show. It's let's talk more about these things that cause us worry, that are really about the kind of most important things in our life, you know, work and money, family, relationships, and death, which is really about, you know, making our lives count and having purpose to what we're doing here. So that was the structure. And of course, death, sex, and money, it catches your attention, but it's really an invitation to come in and have some kind of deeper conversations.
Why do you think it's important that we create a discourse at this point in American culture?
You know, Before I started this show, I was covering politics for years and covered the presidential election in 2012, where I was all across swing states talking to voters. And I was struck by, you know, my assignment was to go out and to find out what these voters thought about the various candidates. But what they wanted to talk to me about was, I want to hear from somebody why it's harder for me to get by working as hard as I've ever worked, and I'm not able to raise my kids the same way that my parents were able to raise me. And so I kept running into this anxiety and this sense of so many of the models in America, not only what our middle class looks like, but also what our families look like and what's enough to get by. So much of that is in flux. And it felt like people were experiencing that on an individual level and not really seeing that it was actually a shared experience. So that was where the idea came from, was let's have a show where we're actually talking about these important things so that you can listen in and hear, oh, I'm actually not alone in this.
And what were some of the things that stuck out initially to you whenever you were meeting these people out on the campaign trail? What's one or two things that people told you that startled you or actually gave you the concept for the show?
I think about two conversations that I had in Iowa. One was with a mother who I was asking her what she thought about Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, and she just started talking about, you know, like, I don't know who is rooting for me. I don't know where I fit anymore because I feel like one candidate is for poor people, another candidate is for rich people, and I don't even know what I am anymore because the price of milk is going up, the price of gas is going up, and my husband and I are working more hours than we've ever worked. So I thought about her a lot, in the sense of isolation that she sort of expressed in frustration and looking for answers and a sense of recognition that what she was experiencing was really hard. And then another conversation I had with a voter in Iowa was I was sitting in a cafe having coffee with a farmer, and we talked about the election for a while, and then we just started talking. And at this point in my life, I had recently been divorced. I was trying to figure out what was going on in my life and how to make relationships work. And I had this long conversation with this farmer who talked about how he was one of five kids and, you know, four of his siblings had multiple marriages, and he was trying to figure out what had worked with he and his wife and where his siblings hadn't made it work. And it was one of the most instructive conversations I've ever had about what it is that it takes to make marriage work. And it didn't fit anywhere in my political coverage. And so I wanted to find a place to have conversations like that.
You started as a reporter here in West Virginia, correct?
That's right. Yeah, my first job in journalism ever was in Charleston for West Virginia Public Radio, and that's where I learned how to do everything.
I have no doubt that people listening right now will remember you from those days. But I'm awfully curious as to the differences in the experiences that you've had as a reporter, starting here, growing up here, and then starting here as a professional journalist, and then going to WNYC. It seems like there might be some differences in the level in which people will disclose, maybe, possibly. Do you see any difference in what people are willing to share with you as a reporter in New York versus West Virginia?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I haven't noticed that difference. I think the hardest thing as a reporter, no matter where you're reporting, is creating a sense of connection with the person you're interviewing. And I think a lot of that, the way you can do that, the way you can make the person you're interviewing feel safe is to say, this is what I'm after and what I'm trying to do with this interview. And so we might talk about some things that make you feel a little bit uncomfortable, but what I want to do is have you tell this story because somebody out there might really relate. So, you know, hearing about what happened when your father passed away when you were a young kid, or hearing about when you had difficult times in your marriage, or hearing about the life choices you had to make when you realized you couldn't afford to live in the city where you'd lived for 30 years. Those are hard things to talk about, but it matters so much to a listening audience to be able to hear that they're not alone. So that's my strategy, or that's my pitch to somebody when I'm asking them to talk about very personal things. It's if you're comfortable sharing this with me and sharing this with listeners, you're going to make other people feel a lot less alone.
Do you think that, given these subjects that you're trying to tackle, do you feel like people are embarrassed to talk about these things, or that it's a cultural thing that we've been, most people are raised to say, you know, you don't talk about this, this, and this in certain company. But, you know, do you think that that's like, that it's a matter of the way people are raised, or it's just a sort of inherent embarrassment about these subjects?
Well, I think certainly these are not conversations that you have, you know, with somebody you first met in polite conversation. You know, this is getting to deeper places. But I've also found in starting this podcast and in talking to people, some of the guests we have are well-known people, and they do interviews all the time. And the best thing to hear at the end of one of those interviews is, wow, no one's ever asked me about this before. And so I think it's also about valuing the kinds of stories about what happens in your daily life when you're going about doing all these extraordinary things, if you're talking to a celebrity. So one of the interviews that's coming up in 2 weeks, a musician named Jason Isbell, who's been on Mountain Stage, I know, who I'm a big fan of. His wife is also a musician, and they've been everywhere. They've had a big year in the last year, but I really wanted to know, wow, you've only been married for a year. Like, what's that been like with your relationship? How do you keep in touch when you're on the road and when you're in different places, and how do you deal with the stresses of the road? And so we talked a lot about that, not as much about each of their albums and the conversations that you've heard elsewhere. So a lot of it, I think, is just saying, you know what, like, this is valuable. This is important stuff to mine. And so I think that's why things like family and relationships and money aren't part of, as prominent a part of the public discourse. It's because these questions just don't get asked.
Do you think it's possible that these aspects of people's lives are so common that they don't think to have a conversation about them in, say, with a reporter? They're easy to have amongst certain company, but a person that you're not familiar with, it may be not so.
Exactly. I think you're right on there. I think something else is, talking about death, sex, and money is not news. It's not news to say sometimes long-term relationships are hard, or sometimes it's embarrassing when you realize you aren't earning enough money. Like, that's not a news story. And as a result, when we hear those stories, it's often, you know, in the first paragraph of a story about health insurance coverage, and then the rest of it is about policy, or, you know, the first paragraph about the story about, tax revenues in a state. It's a, you know, you start with somebody saying, I'm not making as much as I used to make. What I'm making the argument about, my argument is, those stories are worth their own time. It's worth pausing and listening to what that experience is.
And it just came to mind that, you know, shows like This American Life, which part of your podcast is going to be featured on, elements of Radiolab, maybe even, and TED Radio Hour sometimes, mm-hmm. and some of these other public radio programs seem to pull from this level of intimacy and connectedness and the human side of it, as you put it. Is the tide changing in the past, I don't know, decade or so? Or is there sort of these ways of storytelling and connecting with people, is it still sort of parceled out at this point, and that we're just sort of now starting to discover that this is an important way to talk to people and an important way to tell stories?
I think it's both. I think that journalists have done what I'm trying to do for generations. I mean, Charles Kuralt used to go around America and pause and talk to people and ask them about their lives and then tell those stories to the rest of America. Studs Terkel used to collect stories and put together books of just personal histories. And those are incredible collections. So this has been happening for a long time, but I also think that with the advent of digital media and social media, you're seeing, you know, as a journalist, I've felt it like a shift in the level of comfort I have in expressing, you know, things that are happening in my life and the not necessarily opinions, but giving a perspective to something. And I think that's come with shifts in journalism and the advent of social media. And if digital outlets weren't available, I'm not sure this podcast would exist because it exists as a digital radio show. So we distribute as a podcast. That's the primary way that we get listeners. So I think it's both part of a long tradition of journalists wanting to mine these very personal stories, but because of the media moment that I'm lucky to be a journalist in, it's I have this opportunity.
And that proves a good point. You know, this is a podcast; it's not on traditional airwaves. Was there any discussion amongst you and producers and, you know, the folks at the top at WNYC whether or not to put it on the air?
I think the idea is that you know, it's home. The idea is that it's home is going to be a podcast that comes out every 2 weeks. So every 2 weeks, there will be a new episode of Death, Sex, and Money that you can listen to either on your smartphone or online at deathsexmoney.org. And then because we have so many platforms with which where we can put audio, if it's a story that works for the local WNYC newsroom, if it's a character here in New York City, then we make a formatted version for air there, or we break out a segment and I go on a talk show and talk about it on a talk show and have callers join the conversation, or we say to other public radio shows like This American Life, this is a great story that we came upon in Death, Sex, and Money. Maybe you'd like to air it as well. So it's we're putting it together as a podcast and then figuring out opportunity by opportunity when it might make sense to put it on the broadcast signal.
Sure. I do want to speak a little bit about what you've made available of the program itself. Mm-hmm. In the first episode, you speak with West Virginia native Bill Withers about his life and career in music, a little bit about the business side of music, a little bit about his personal life and growing up here in West Virginia. Aside from him being a native of this state, your home state, and the fact that he's a famous person, why him?
Why him? It's very simple. I first got to talk to Bill Withers when I was a reporter at West Virginia Public Radio. He came through with the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame event, the first induction ceremony, and I got to interview him back then, which was several years ago. And I have thought back on that interview so many times, just about the way he talked about life, which was both this immense feeling. He has a way of expressing very simply what's most important in life and urging you to let go of the rest of the drama. And I find it just so refreshing. So I reached out to Bill Withers with help of Michael Lipton there in Charleston, who connected me. And sure enough, I heard stories I'd never heard before from Bill Withers and that we talked about growing up, his growing up in Slab Fork and then growing up in Beckley when his parents split up and taking care of his father when his father was ailing. He was just a boy. Bill Withers was just a boy when his father died, 13 years old. And hearing him talk about that and then also who his male role models were in West Virginia after his father passed away, it's a great interview. He's a man that I just want to hear talk. And so that was why I said, will you come on this new show that I'm starting?
In another episode of the podcast, Anna, you tell a story about your own love life by speaking with former U.S. Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming and how he and his wife helped save your own relationship. Set it up for us, and then we'll go to a clip.
Sure. So I was broken up with my boyfriend, Arthur, and we were struggling with long distance, I had some questions about whether it really was going to work long term. And being in my 30s, I just felt like I couldn't waste time on something that didn't have a future. So we were split up, and Arthur asked Senator Alan Simpson for help. He wrote him a letter and asked Alan Simpson to give me a call to ask me to come out to Wyoming for this event that was happening. And Al Simpson did it. He called me on my cell phone. He said, look, I don't know you two. I don't know what's going on, but I know that all relationships have their hard times. Ann and I certainly have. His wife, Ann, they've been married 60 years. And so out of this kind of crazy plea from Arthur, this letter to Alan Simpson, whom he didn't know, this relationship blossomed between the four of us, where they opened up about just how about their relationship and their marriage and how they'd gotten through difficult times. And it ended up being a really not only a wonderful interview to hear, but for me, transformative, because it really did help me kind of relax and think about commitment as something you decide to do together, and that you don't have to have all the details figured out, but you decide to form a partnership, and that's how it works.
Okay, what did you, when you first read that,
thought it was the oddity of the ages. And I looked at it, put it away, and then Ann and I were in Denver, and I said, I got to do something with this thing. I think I'll just toss it. And Ann looked at it, and she said, worth a try.
This is just the sweetest letter. And I thought, that would be a shame not to call.
With esteem and humility, he ends.
He seemed very desperate.
It seems really peculiar because whenever people have relationship issues, they either speak to a family member or a counselor.
Not to retired politicians.
I mean, is it just simply the fact that he's a person that's been married? Is that his qualification, or is it something deeper, or the fact that he even responded?
Well, it's a couple of things. I think Arthur, my boyfriend, he reached out to Alan Simpson because we were in one of those places where we were locked in. You know, everything felt hard and strained, and we'd had all these talks, and it just felt hard. And Arthur thought, I think if Alan Simpson calls Anna, she'll laugh. And it started with that idea, like just to shift the dynamic, she'll laugh, Of course, I did. Alan Simpson calls me up, and I laughed as we're talking about relationships. And Arthur had no way of knowing, but Alan Simpson and his wife Anne are sort of they take a lot of joy in sharing advice of what they've learned about their relationship. They're very open. They talk about their couples counseling. They talk about their difficult times. They talk about how they disagreed about how Al treated Anita Hill when she was testifying before his committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, in 1991. So they're very honest about the ups and downs of their marriage. And so that was just an unanticipated gift. I mean, how could Arthur have known when he was asking this crazy favor of Alan Simpson that in fact this couple would actually really invest in us and want to help us through?
Sure. In the case of Senator Simpson and yourself and your boyfriend, it doesn't seem as awkward as one might expect. You know, after all, you agreed to meet with him, still stay in touch with them, but was putting that out as part of the podcast difficult? Or do you believe that that's the way to get buy-in from your audience and those that you may want to talk to in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I thought a lot about that because the story of Alan Simpson's weird involvement in my relationship is a great story to tell to my loved ones and friends at dinner parties, and the idea of making it public is a whole other thing. But as I talked to Arthur about it, as I thought about what I wanted this podcast to be about, it felt really like it made sense to have one of the first episodes be about me not having all the answers and how I found help for that in the most unlikely of places. So certainly waking up this morning and realizing that I was, you know, telling this story about my love life to all you people was kind of caused some anxiety, but in the end, I really believe in it. I really believe that by showing a little bit of vulnerability, it just maybe it'll encourage other people to come on the show and to know what the show's about, which is this is the place where we're going to have some fun, we're going to talk about some hard things, and in the end, it's going to be conversations that really matter.
And it leads me to a question. Why is it so embarrassing for people to have conversations about relationships and sex and death and money and all these other big issues of our time when everyone is dealing with the exact same thing?
I think when you talk about death, sex, and money, it takes admitting that you don't have all the answers and there's some things that make you uncomfortable. And that's really scary when you're talking about relationships. That's really scary when you're talking about money. And it's, you know, when you're talking about mortality, you know, the existential, underpinnings of why we're here, that's big stuff. And it's, so I think that it has to be a safe space to want to talk about that kind of thing. And that's what I've really tried to do with this podcast, is to say, here's a podcast. It's going to sound like a radio show, but we're going to like go right at some of these issues. We're going to go at some hard things. And, but after you listen, you're going to feel less alone. You're going to know that other people are grappling with these questions. And that is really healing.
I guess that leads me to the question, does humility equal intimacy?
That's a good question. I think it takes humility for intimacy because you have to be willing to listen. It takes humility to listen. And, I mean, that is the experience of radio, you know, working in radio, the experience of hearing somebody's voice telling you something you didn't know is a humbling experience. And that's why radio feels so special. So yeah, I think humility is necessary for intimacy. And when you have that humility, it creates intimacy, and then that leads to more humility and leads to more connection.
And final question, what can people expect in the future of the show? They've heard three podcasts or three sections already. What can you tell them as far as what's coming, and what do you hope? And I know this is a ridiculous question maybe, but when someone hears it, what do you want them to do?
Well, first of all, when somebody hears it now, I want them to think, oh my gosh, I want to hear more of this. Because that confirms what our suspicion is, which is that these kinds of conversations will have an audience and there's a quiet demand for it. So I hope that they go to iTunes and subscribe. I hope they like us on Facebook and all that sort of thing and share it with their friends. What will happen from now here on out, every Wednesday on a biweekly basis, a new episode will come out. It may be an interview with somebody you heard of, a celebrity. We've got interviews with, as I said, we've got interviews with Jason Isbell coming up, the musician, he and his wife, Amanda Shires, Jane Fonda is on the show coming up. And also everyday people who are dealing with things like figuring out how to raise a family, figuring out how to mourn the passing of a mother when you were young and trying to grapple with that as an adult. I don't know, big questions. And so that's every Wednesday you'll get a new episode. But what will be consistent is that we think these stories matter. We think that it's fun to listen to them, and you will feel more connected when you are done with an episode of Death, Sex, and Money.
Great, Anna. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.